Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that did have a funny opening line before it was blocked by the DUP. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
Also with me is Cho of Birmingham Fabian's Luke John Davis.
You're right.
And also, very excitingly, in her first podcast, I think, for us since she was elected Birmingham Deputy Leader, is Bridget Jones. Hello, Bridget.
Hello.
Although the DUP may have blocked my opening line, they have agreed to a form of words that might lead to a way forward in the Brexit negotiations. But will it still all end in tears? Let's just quickly go through the chronology then of what's happened this week. There were briefings on last weekend that we were close to a breakthrough in the Brexit negotiations. Then it turned out that no one had told the DUP about the wording on the Irish border question. Presumably that's because the minister in charge of maintaining relations between the government and the DUP is Damien Green, who I think has been, shall we say, distracted?
A little bit busy, being investigated for various things.
Yeah. The DUP blocked the wording on the Irish border because it sounded like almost one of the options that the government was considering is essentially having a hard border on the edge of Ireland rather than between Northern Ireland and the Republic. That led to 3 or 4 days of the government running around going, oh my God, what the hell are we doing? That led on Friday morning, so yesterday when we're recording this, to actually an agreement being struck that the EU Commission's happy with, and Jean-Claude Juncker has said that he's happy for talks to go forward. The DUP have said that they're now happy, and Theresa May has said she's happy. And even more amazingly, Brexiter Tory MPs and Remainer Tory MPs have come out and said this is all right.
Basically, yeah. They've kicked the can down the road.
Yeah. When you actually look at an awful lot of the wording in the agreement that's been published, it is a classic case of, you know, an EU last-minute midnight fudge just to keep the ball rolling and keep everything progressing in some form. The only real thing of, I suppose, a note actually in the document itself is the fact that it sets up the Good Friday Agreement, basically as being the kind of like the linchpin for the Irish, Northern Irish and Irish border, which, you know, makes total sense, and you can see why that is. But it does mean that, in effect, that anything that we do moving forward, the Good Friday Agreement and maintaining that soft border in some form has to be the baseline for all of the negotiations moving forward.
Yeah. Good Friday Agreement is a recognised international treaty registered with the UN. I mean, it has far more legal force than an advisory referendum. I think the other thing to bear in mind here is that they have put in essence, a fallback option of remaining in the customs union. Mm-hmm. Now, it is entirely possible that when everything else falls apart, because, you know, it's not really doable, that is the solution that ends up happening. So I think almost buried in the small print is a path to a soft Brexit, which personally I'm very pleased about, which is why the Remainer options are there. They've also at the same time said that's not a preferred option, we're going to find another way, which has kind of kept the Brexiteers on side. So that's the essence of the fudge that's allowed the Tories to remain some semblance of unity.
Hmm. Yeah. If you want to buy EU negotiation midnight fudge, you can find it online at the Not Enough Champagne store. There's also an agreement on EU citizens, which is has been quite important for the last few months in the negotiations, and it was agreed that EU citizens in the UK and UK citizens in the EU have a right to stay, partners in long-term relationships can stay, their children can stay, and ECJ jurisdiction over EU citizens here will continue for 8 years after Britain's withdrawn from the EU.
But there is a limit on how many cases per year are likely to be brought up to the actual ECJ itself. So it's like something like 3 or 4 cases a year. It's, in effect, the ECJ's ability to have a say on laws is based on precedent. So if, you know, something happens in, you know, in Spain, which gets taken up to the European Court of Justice, and that sets a precedent for something that that could affect the UK or kind of EU citizens in the UK, that will then be taken into account. But only, as I say, a small handful of cases can be raised each year by basically EU citizens in the UK itself. Which, again, I feel like is one of those kind of a soft ball to be thrown at the Brexiters. So that they have something to say, oh, look, no, we're definitely limited there, they say, when in reality, you know, we're still upholding the precedent, and that's the important thing,
and
really.
And every lower court acts as a lower court of the ECJ anyway, so other cases could be tried at lower courts potentially. Whether they still remain lower courts of the ECJ after is a different question, but they will probably still be bound by precedents and so on set by the ECJ while we were a member. So it's really interesting from this. If you're looking at this from a sort of Brexiteers' perspective, right? Their first demand, so, you know, the way these negotiations are going, we must have no ECJ oversight at all. Well, there's now ECJ oversight. We must have no option to remain in the customs union. Well, that's now the fallback option.
We must not pay any money for the divorce bill. That's the other thing we haven't talked about yet, but that's happening as well.
On the divorce bill, I think the agreed figure that I saw is somewhere between £35 and £39 billion, which is kind of just about halfway between the £20 billion it seemed like the British government said at the start and the £60 billion the EU was talking about. They also said cooperation on nuclear regulation and police, which is nice. So hopefully British nuclear power stations will work in 2 years' time, which is nice. Then in terms of the Irish border question, upholding the Good Friday Agreement, which I'm guessing in practice basically means no hard border, no customs checks and what have you. The stipulation still is that the whole of the UK would leave the customs union, and in the absence of any agreement, the UK would ensure full alignment with the rules of the customs union and the single market, which I'm guessing is kind of code for a soft Brexit. What this strikes me as being a bit like is during the coalition years where the Tories would say, we want to repeal the Human Rights Act and instead have a British Bill of Rights. And you would say, okay then, which bit of the Human Rights Act do you not want? And which bits would you not want in this British Bill of Rights? And essentially what they would have done is copy and pasted the Human Rights Act and put it into a British Bill of Rights. We're now going to spend the next 10 years negotiating a free trade agreement with the EU that basically replicates the customs union and the single market. You talked about the courts and the Brexiters not wanting any court jurisdiction over us. What it feels like is going to happen is we're not even going to have jurisdiction of the EFTA court over us. What we're basically going to happen is we'll set up our own kind of special British court with special British judges who'll have to follow all the precedents from the ECJ and EFTA anyway.
It's a fundamental misunderstanding of how international trade works. Even China follows EU regulations because they are the most stringent regulations in world trade. So if you can meet the EU regulations, you can sell them anywhere. If you don't meet the EU regulations, you can't sell them in the biggest market in the world. Even China manufactures goods to EU standards, even without any kind of agreement or any kind of regulatory oversight or what have you, simply because if it doesn't do that, it can't sell them. Now, British firms are going to do exactly the same thing. So it's always been a little bit of a red herring of, you know, we want to get out of these regulations, rah, 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 red tape. Because essentially any British company that still wants to manufacture goods and be able to sell them in an international market is going to have to follow every single EU regulation. Except we will have no say in what those regulations are, how they're governed or how they're decided. Which was a main argument of Remain, and Gisela Stewart this week has been complaining and saying, well, we'll have to follow all these rules that we have no say in. And we're sitting there going, yes, we told you that repeatedly ad nauseam during the campaign.
Sounds like China should try and take back control as well.
Well, this is it. I mean, you know,
The other thing, I suppose, is that this free trade agreement that may well be conducted, Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator this week, said that the model was the Canada deal. And I think it's CETA plus, isn't it? I think that Theresa May has talked about doing. And the thing with the Canada trade deal is, well, A, it took 7 years to negotiate. And then 6 months to ratify was nearly blocked by a Belgian regional parliament. So that's going to be fun. Also, it's less generous terms in the single market than the EEA, so the stuff you've talked about, LJ, still applies. But the other thing is, the Canada trade deal apparently doesn't cover financial services, which obviously would be a big part of any trade deal for Britain. So
the other thing, to give you an idea, the Canada trade deal has 1,598 pages. It has taken us 15 months to agree on 15 pages.
It comes back to the problem that's plagued it since the beginning, though. the argument for leaving the EU is an emotional one, not a logical one.
Mm.
And funnily enough, we're finding out the finer details of exactly how illogical that was now.
The original sin, as Tim Farron might put it, seems to come back to the decision by that Theresa May made with two of her key advisers, well, then advisers, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, September last year, where they said, basically, the referendum was all about immigration. We can't control immigration if we're part of the single market customs union. We need a clean break from that. Well, many people complain about the Sofa government of the Blair years and the Cameron years. That was a decision made in an office with three people, two of whom have never been elected to any post. There's still, from what Philip Hammond was saying this week, there hasn't even been a cabinet discussion yet on what they want the end deal of Brexit to look
because
like.
Because they'll just throw the chairs at each other if they try and have one.
On the one hand, the achievement of May and the achievement was almost her main achievement, and what's clear this week is she's been trying to keep the show on the road without really having any discussions, because if you have discussions, then yeah, you may end up with resignations or firings or what have you. Maybe she's keeping the show on the road a little bit longer. But at some point, there needs to be a discussion. You've got Michael Gove, who's quoting The Guardian today, saying, oh, well, if the British people don't like the terms they're given, maybe a future government can try and change them and come back into the EU. And you think, what the...
Have you seen Jeremy Hunt's interventions in the media this week, where he's basically turned to the Tory Brexiteers and said, all right, call the bluff. Let's see what sort of Brexit deal you get out of Jeremy Corbyn.
It's also a very, very dysfunctional government in which we have... Well, my favourite round this week was maybe the one between our very gothic Chancellor Philip Hammond and the assassin-faced baby Gavin Williamson, who's now Defence Secretary. Philip Hammond now has been banned from... or blocked from going on MOD flights until the Treasury pays... I think it's £100,000 or something the Treasury owes the MOD for flights, and so Gavin Williamson has blocked Philip Hammond from going on any flights until they cough up the bill, which is not petty in the slightest.
No. To go back to Brexit, rather than the pettiness of the Tories, which we could be here all day with, we have got so het up on the process and the technicalities of Brexit, we have forgotten the cause. And like Bridget said, it was an emotional thing. Nick Timothy and Theresa May and Fiona Hill decided it's about immigration. But as we've all been on the doorstep. Immigration is always a code for something else. It is a code for feeling insecure economically. You feel there's not enough jobs and you're in competition, or there's not enough housing and you're in competition for housing. It is always a code, or you're feeling culturally insecure. So immigration is always a code for something deeper. And we've not addressed any of the deeper causes of Brexit, because, as you know, going around Brandwood and Bilsley around here, it was as much of a kick against Westminster as it was against Brussels.
Well, and the tragic thing is that because we're having to spend so much time negotiating over Brexit process and basically sprinting to stand still, we don't actually have the political... We don't have the time or the capacity to try and address any of those issues.
And there is only one person who's making these arguments, and it's Tony Blair. And it's, you know, probably the worst possible messenger you could choose to make them, but they're arguments that need to be made. So even if, you know, you turn this into the offshore tax haven that Aaron Banks and others have been aiming for from all of this, you're not going to have actually resolved the issues in the country that the referendum actually highlighted and brought up. Tough on Brexit, tough on the causes of Brexit.
I don't really want to talk about that. I just want to talk about the pettiness of the Tories. And on that, can we please talk about Alan Partridge meets Ray Mears, our Brexit Secretary David Davis? So,
still think that's an insult to Ray Mears.
So October last year, David Davis says that there are 51 impact assessments being made on Brexit, which are going to inform the approach of Britain in the negotiations. Yes, I laughed at inform Britain's approach in the negotiations as well. He told the Brexit Committee in December last year there were 57 of these impact assessments. He told the House of Commons in February this year that there were 58, and again they were to shape the Britain's negotiating position, which, as we can agree, has been a great success so far. Then in June he said that there were 50, nearly 60 of these completed, at which point Labour said, well, could we see them? And David Davis said no, because that might jeopardise our negotiating position. Now, the line basically has moved from, it was in excruciating detail, and this week Hilary Benn asked David Davis if they had been produced, and David Davis said that they didn't exist. And there was no point in having them because the usefulness would be near zero, because you can't really do an impact assessment on economic effects anyway.
Yeah, this is absolutely ridiculous behaviour from David Davis on this front. Either he was lying to the House when he said that these impact assessments exist, or he's lying now and they do exist, they have been done properly in some form, and they really just don't want to show them because of how bad they're going to look.
So, Bridget, you are the only one of us who actually has a kind of job doing governing stuff, I believe is a technical term.
That is the technical term, yes.
Now, do you do impact assessments in your work at the council?
So, legally, we have to do an equalities impact assessment on pretty much every decision we take. So these are very commonplace for us. Every cabinet report, every committee report we take through will have a section on financial implications, on implications of the wider council. So yeah, it's a pretty standard thing for us to do. We were sat there in cabinet yesterday. We had a special cabinet meeting for the Commonwealth Games, which we're hoping to bring to Birmingham in 2022, back the bid. And the leader of the Tories sat there and lambasted us for not having completed full impact assessments on every aspect of the game so far, which was sort of met by a stunned silence from the rest of us going, really? You have seen David Davis this week, right?
You should have just said you have them in excruciating detail and we're going to tell him.
My assumption is that there are documents like this knocking around that show the situation is going to be so appallingly bad. Honestly, from the look on the outside, it kind of looks like Boris Johnson and David Davis are at the point where they're almost like, what the hell have we done? And Liam Fox is just sitting with his head in the sand going, la 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 la. I assume that they've got them and they have essentially renamed them to remove the words impact and assessment in a bid to try and technically comply. It's going to be interesting to see whether John Bercow accepts this. Now, I suspect, watching John Bercow from afar for several years, he's not. I don't think, you know, he is very hot on the respect of Parliament and the respect of the Commons, and I suspect there may be something coming there. He's also, although he's, you know, coming from the Conservatives, they tried to kick him out, don't forget, in 2015. This year, or was it 2015? Just before one of the elections, they tried to get rid of Bercow. So there's no love lost. So that's going to be interesting to see what the speakers do.
My money is on they exist, but they've been rebadged or buried. Yeah. It is impossible to take a decision in government that is judicial review proof without having done all that kind of due diligence. The council has lost judicial reviews on far, far smaller infractions and oversights than that. They must exist somewhere, is my take on it. But of course they don't want them to see them. It's going to be a bloodbath.
In which case it basically boils down to perhaps that moving forward, like in terms of talking about Tory party pettiness and all of that, is when do they get leaked? If they do exist at some point, though, at least one or two of those are going to get leaked.
Or freedom of information.
But I suspect with the FOI they would find a way to get around that. I think if they do exist, a leak of some kind is likely to be the only way we get them. I think the likelihood of that happening will kind of be determined by if there's a massive falling out in cabinet. If you end up in a situation where, let's say, the few Remainers that there are in the cabinet end up being pushed out, you know, bits of information suddenly start appearing.
Steve, I said earlier in the podcast that it looks like maybe she's kept the show on, Theresa May's kept the show on the road for maybe the next few months, maybe the next 18 months, which obviously inevitably means the government will fall next week. what do you think is going to happen vis-a-vis her position? Do you think this now means that she's got the space to negotiate Brexit to keep people happy? Or if the can's kicked down the road, are we just going to end up with a massive falling out in 3 or 4 months' time and we'll be back in the same position we were earlier in the week?
I think Theresa May has managed to put herself in a position where she can get to 2019 and the end of the Article 50 period and basically spend all her time focusing on just getting some basics in place for that implementation transitional period. Once she's got to that bit, she can then potentially, if she survives, step aside and go, look, I've done my job, it's time for somebody else to come in. And actually handle the full negotiations. The problem is she's got to last to that point, and there's still an awful lot of things which can go wrong in between now and then.
I would love to be a fly on the wall in some of the back room discussions, because the other thing is they will have someone lined up there, and it's going to be interesting to see who it will be and who the options are, because the Conservative cabinet is essentially bed blocking. Mm-hmm. It's all the same old dinosaurs that have been there for the last 10 years. Is there going to be a runner from the pack from the 2010-2015?
David Cameron.
Yeah, essentially. Exactly. And if so, who would that be?
I mean, I wrote a piece actually on this on the Not Enough Champagne site, kind of looking at kind of like potential Tory leadership hopefuls a while back. I mean, this was peak when Johnson was being talked up again as a possible leader. Yeah. I know, and my core point was he's not inevitable.
Yeah.
There are a lot of potential people. I mean, just off the top of my head, you've got people like James Cleverley, Tom Tugendhat.
It's still not a real name. He's not a real person.
What's his name? The one who went to Keith Palmer's aid in the terrorist incident.
Oh,
Tobias Elwood, is it?
Yeah, Tobias Elwood. Yeah. Those sorts of kind of level of people who are an awful lot of them are very strong performers.
Mm.
And a number of them have got a lot of different things going for them. And there is by all reports, a kind of a bit of a grouping happening amongst that kind of level and that kind of intake of MPs across basically the 2010 and 2015 generation. There was some stories which did the rounds this week about David Davis trying to position himself as the next Prime Minister, basically, by seemingly trying to get that kind of contingent of Tory MPs on board with him. Basically, the idea being if he were to be made Prime Minister, suddenly out goes Boris, out goes Hammond, out goes Fox. In comes Rachel McLean for the MP for Redditch. In comes Tom Tugendhat as Foreign Secretary. In comes Johnny Mercer at Defence. You know, all of those sorts of figures.
Yeah, and if those 2010-2015 people work together, depending on how the other parts of the party split and they're supporting, I could see them getting the person onto the ballot to face off against Amber Rudd. And then winning amongst the members.
Yeah, at this point, my money's on someone like James Cleverley.
Yeah.
Very good background in terms of where he's come from. Ethnic minority is able to, you know, once more kind of give the Tories the ability to say, actually, we're the ones who are doing the firsts in terms of leadership and all of that. That's the sort of person I think they'll be looking at.
I think in terms of next Tory leader, a lot will depend on what happens with the next cabinet reshuffle, which I think we can assume will probably happen. I think last time we were recording, we thought it might be about this time. Actually, it looks like it'll probably not be until the new year, and it'll be interesting to see who of that 2010-2015 intake does get promoted into a more senior spot.
Merry Christmas, Liam Fox, you're fired.
We have our end of year shows coming out. We have one on, I don't know if you remember, listeners, there was a general election back in June, and we'll be looking back on that next week. Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times, and that was done by Dave Deppert. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne, and our website is notenoughchampagne.com. I'm on Twitter at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Centre Radical.
I'm at LJDavies87, Davies with an E.
And I'm at Bridget Jones, Bridget with a G.
Happy plotting!